Kings last night, 3-1. Blackhawks are off tonight. Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service. For this Tuesday, the 20th, cloudy and warm, more rain likely, and falling temperatures throughout the day. We also have a flood watch through the afternoon. Tonight, cloudy, foggy, mixture of freezing rain, snow, and sleet. Tonight's low 22. Tomorrow, partly sunny, a return to seasonal temperatures. Tomorrow's high only 33. This morning, pretty nice, 57 Kenosha, 52 Racine, wind from the south-southwest at 10. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 8:11, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show here on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We're going to spend most of the hour with a brilliant concert pianist by the name of Simone Dinerstein, who is coming to perform a concert at Carthage College this Thursday evening. Before we get to that interview and to some samples of her wonderful playing, we want to remind you of Wisconsin Public Radio's Winter Membership Drive, which is running now through Saturday. If you appreciate what you hear over Wisconsin Public Radio, and particularly appreciate what you hear over WGTD, including programs like The Morning Show, please express your appreciation in a tangible way by making a donation to Wisconsin Public Radio. You can do so online at www.wpr.org, or you can call toll-free 1-888-202-2552. Again, 1-888-202-2552. And if you call Wisconsin Public Radio, please mention that you are a listener to The Morning Show. And thank you for your support and encouragement. 12 minutes after 8 o'clock, here's part one of today's morning show. And that is the marvelous playing of Simone Dinerstein, playing one of the variations from the famous Goldberg variations of Johann Sebastian Bach, one of the most important, renowned works for keyboard in the history of music. And it is a work that is very closely identified with Simone Dinerstein, one of the world's most renowned concert pianists. And it is a very, very special privilege and treat for us to be able to experience the artistry of Simone Dinerstein this Thursday evening in Siebert Chapel on the campus of Carthage College as part of Carthage's Piano Festival. And I'm very, very honored to speak with her about her very intriguing career and some of the really marvelous things that she has done both on and off the concert stage. Simone Dinerstein, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you for having me.
I'm very, very excited about this. I have heard a little bit about your beginnings as a very serious piano student. My understanding is that you got a relatively late start when it comes to people who attain the kind of enormous success that you have. You were actually as old as 7 years old, I think, before you began your piano study. Why that late start, relatively late start?
Well, I actually asked my parents if I could start having lessons when I was around five. I was taking ballet classes at that time, and there was a pianist who played in our class, who played Chopin, and that's how I discovered the piano. But we were at that time living in Rome, in Italy. My father is a painter, and we were there because he was at the American Academy in Rome. And my parents, don't have a background in classical music, and they thought that five seemed very young to start lessons, and we didn't have a piano, and so they said, "Why don't we wait till we move back to New York?" And so that's really what happened. We moved back when I was seven, and I reminded them, and that's when I started my piano lessons.
Do you feel like that had any bearing on the kind of pianist you became and sort of the ferocity with which you pursued this, that in a sense you had to wait to begin?
Well, it could be. I mean, I think that the main thing is that the desire to play came from me. And I think that that's not always the case with musicians. A lot of musicians I know, their parents started them on an instrument. And also, there's generally speaking a tradition to have like pretty involved support from parents with practicing over the years. I mean, many of my friends, their parents went with them to their lessons and helped them practice during the week. My parents were very supportive, but they didn't see that as their role, and so I really was in charge of my own practicing and understanding what happened in the lessons. And so I think that made me had more ownership of the whole experience. Mm.
I've heard your mother in an interview say something to the effect that one of the things that sort of gave her pause when you expressed your hopes of someday being a professional concert pianist, that might be a very difficult road, an achievement you might not ultimately be able to attain, and that the road might really be kind of a lonely one. What has the road been like? I mean, particularly in the early going, in a sense, did you have much of a sense of what you were getting yourself into, and what, for instance, your childhood and indeed all of your life would really be?
Well, I think that it's a very kind of winding path, and I've been very lucky in that I've had some very important supporters. I mean, my parents, to start with, have always been incredibly supportive to me. And also my husband, who I met when I was 15, so he's been on the ride for a long time. He has been tremendously supportive. And I think that having those three people in my life always there for me has been invaluable. I think that it is a very lonely road, and there's a lot of rejection and, you know, many things that don't work out. And you know, I'm now in a position where a lot of young pianists will actually ask me for advice, come play for me, and, you know, want to know, you know, what they should do next. And it's pretty clear to me that there are just a million ways to be a musician, that there's not just one path, that being a traveling soloist, first of all, there are hardly any people that actually can support themselves doing that. And there just are, you know, there's just so much, there's so much competition for that, and so many different reasons that go into people succeeding that might not even have anything to do with the way they play. And the main thing is to feel like you're actually able to have a rich life in music, and that's the most important thing.
Right. If you're a pianist, there are things to do besides Carnegie Hall, and if you're a singer, there are places to sing besides the Met, and indeed all kinds of worthwhile pathways. Let's talk about the Goldberg Variations, which certainly has been a very important part of your professional life. It was your recording in 2007 that really vaulted you to extraordinary fame. But your first encounter with the Goldberg Variations, or certainly the moment that you fell in love with it, dates way back to high school. Tell our listeners about this intriguing moment when you first experienced what you call, I think, a moment of epiphany.
Yeah, I was around 13, and a friend of mine in high school, he played me the recording, the second recording of Gold, the 81 recording, and I just really remember that moment of hearing the aria of the recording and thinking I had never heard anything like that, and that it was, you know, it was just one of those moments that, you know, you feels like you're on the cusp of something else. And, you know, we all have memories of seeing something or hearing something that just kind of changed how we felt about the world. And I think that recording really, it really changed how I thought about music. I think before then, I had been much more interested in music that was more overtly kind of demonstrative. I mean, I think my roots from ballet, I had always been very interested in ballet music and big emotion and drama and pianism, you know, a certain kind of technical brilliance in music. And when I heard Gould play that aria, which was just so incredibly pure and emotional in a very still way, that just immediately influenced my aesthetic, and I think changed how I played after that.
Thank you.
Well, certainly you have made history with not only your marvelous recording of the Goldberg Variations from 2007, but in the many performances you have given of it since. And something very intriguing that you helped create this past fall, something called New Work for Goldberg Variations, a collaboration with a choreographer by the name of Pam Tanowitz. Just say a brief word about what sort of led you to explore this sort of new approach to this Bach masterpiece.
Yeah, I've always been interested in working with a choreographer and working with dancers, and it seemed to me that the Goldberg Variations would be a really perfect piece to explore. It has a history of having been choreographed by various choreographers. I think maybe the most famous one was Jerome Robbins, who choreographed it for the New York City Ballet. And in fact, I did play in that version of it. I collaborated with the Paris Opera Ballet a couple of years ago to do a run of those performances. but I thought it'd be really interesting to be part of the creative process of making a dance to the Goldberg Variations. And Pam Tanowitz is a New York-based choreographer who almost always works with live music and generally speaking, is very interested in contemporary music. And I don't think she's ever done anything to Bach before. And so I approached her, and she was really intrigued by this and challenged by the thought of doing something to such a huge work. And we wound up spending about a year workshopping it together, having residencies. So I spent quite a number of weeks with the dancers and her through the creative process, you know, talking about the phrasing and the rhythm and the structure and how that would manifest itself in actual physical movement. And we just did all of the premiere performances of it this past fall, and it was very successful. It really it was a very exciting process putting it together, and we're going to continue to keep touring it in the upcoming seasons.
So when you continue to perform a work like the Goldberg Variations, but not in what we were just describing in this collaboration with dance, but in a sense a straight performance like you will deliver Thursday evening, what is it like for you now to play this work after so many years of living with it and exploring it? I mean, how differently, for instance, do you approach it now? How different will Thursday night's performance be from performance that you have delivered of it in the past?
Well, I think that this is one of the questions that I have to face about playing a piece of music that I've played for so long, is, you know, how does it change and how does it remain the same? And the way that I mean, part of living with a piece of music is the ongoing process of working on it. So while it may seem, oh, well, you know, she probably knows the piece inside out, I continue to work on it. So I continue to practice it, and when I'm in the privacy of my own studio, I'm still really exploring it, and I keep on finding new things in it. I mean, basically, that's the genius of this piece of music by Bach, is that it you know, there's kind of an endless depth to it, and endless layers to it that you can keep on finding. In the process of performing it, the main thing is that the challenge is to be fully present while playing it, and to allow myself to, in a way, hear it for the first time while I'm playing it. And that's quite challenging, you know, considering I've played it so much. But if you play and you're just listening while you're playing, then really it is always a surprise what comes next. And I'm not thinking about how I plan to play it or trying something new. It's not so conscious. In a performance, I try not to be so conscious. I try to be more receptive to what happens as it's going. So some things have a continuity that they relate to how I've played it before, and other things can be surprisingly different.
I suppose it has a lot to do with responding to the piano you are playing, and in an unfamiliar space in which you are playing. I should think that that brings to bear very powerful influences on how a given performance will ultimately unfold.
Yeah, that's a really good point, and that, you know, one of the challenges of being a pianist is that you're always playing on a different instrument, and that can be frustrating, but also it can be quite interesting because every piano has a different kind of character and strengths and weaknesses, and that can bring out different aspects of the music. So I definitely use that as part of what makes a performance feel fresh to me, and also the acoustical space affects how a piece is played as well. I mean, there are so many factors, you know, how you feel that day, you're traveling, you know, your feeling of jet lag or whatever, but I try not to think too much about whether something needs to be different or the same. Basically, the experience is its own experience that day, and that's part of what a live performance makes a live performance unique, is that it really only exists in that moment, and by definition, it will be different because it's a new moment.
I have to say, of your many recordings, and most of them, or at least certainly a wide swath of them, are devoted to the music of Bach. But I have also really appreciated, for instance, your dazzling recording of the Concerto in G by Frenchman Maurice Ravel. And I also love a modern piano concerto, The Circle and the Child by Philip Lasser, which is on that same recording. And I'm trying to remember now if that was a concerto crafted especially for you.
Yes. Philip Lasser wrote The Circle and the Child for me, and and it's really a very special piece. I'm so glad that you mentioned it. He did write it very specifically for me. We have a very close friendship, and I've played a lot of his music, and he really understands my playing and my sensibility, my musical sensibility. We share a lot in our values and our love for Bach. And I think that sometimes I think of that concerto as almost a kind of letter that he wrote to me in music. But it's a very beautiful piece, and I've performed it quite a few times.
Can you explain the title, The Circle and the Child?
The piece is he uses a Bach chorale in the piece, and there's a sense of the music circling around this chorale in a certain kind of a way, but also a sense of innocence and experience and the circle of life that contains that. So there's a feeling in the music of a kind of purity, a childlike purity that comes through, especially in the third movement, but that in a sense you feel that the music could almost turn again and begin again, and in a kind of T.S. Eliot way, you know, the ending is the beginning. It's very poetic, so it's hard to give a hard and fast definition of what the circle and the child means, but I would say that basically it's about, you know, the cycle of life, and I think that the music really shows this feeling of continuity.
Well, it is a gorgeous piece indeed, and I can see how he would have been inspired by your own artistry to craft such a lovely work for you. I want to finish by being sure to give you a chance to talk about something that I know has been near and dear to your heart. And I think it's one of the most commendable things that you have done in a long list of commendable artistic endeavors that have been the hallmark of your career. I want you to explain to our listeners what the Neighborhood Classics series is all about and what prompted you to put this together back in 2009.
So... That started, my husband is a public school elementary teacher at our local public school in Park Slope, Brooklyn, which also happens to be the school where I went when I was a child, and my mother taught there, and our son went to school there, so it's a real family building. And I decided in 2009 that I really wanted to try to address this kind of growing concern that the classical music community has in the United States about dwindling audiences and the lack of interest in classical music, education of classical music. And I thought that the best thing I could do was to do something in my own community. And the school seemed a natural fit. So I decided to start an evening concert series, which I call Neighborhood Classics, where I would invite musicians to perform evening recitals that would be only an hour long, a combination of performing pieces of music and also, you know, talking about them to the audience, that I would host the concerts, introducing the musicians to the audience and having a brief interview with them during the concert, and that the musicians would donate their performances, and therefore not only would these be opportunities for the community to hear great music, but the ticket sales would then benefit the school and the arts programs that are going on in the school. And the series became really incredibly successful. Pretty much all of our concerts have been sold out, and we get a very wide range of people that come, from kids to their grandparents and great-grandparents, and people from the school community as well as people from the general Park Slope community, and even in a greater New York City community come to the concerts. We've had wonderful musicians, Richard Stoltzman and Paul Odette, and Brad Meldow. I mean, many, many, many musicians have donated their performances to the school. And it's been just a really wonderful way of me being able to bring music to my friends and neighbors and encourage a generation of children to have grown up now hearing concerts.
Very nicely put, and I commend you for that. And I want to say that so many people are excited about this opportunity to see you and hear you perform the Goldberg Variations on Thursday evening. Tell us how this has come about, your performance at Carthage.
Oh, this came about from Weil, who is a pianist on the faculty who also studied. We both studied with the same piano teacher at Manhattan School of Music, Solomon Mikofsky, and he very kindly invited me to come perform. So that's how this all happened.
Very good. So your performance of the Goldberg Variations is this Thursday evening, 7:30 p.m. in Siebert Chapel. The event is free, but tickets do need to be reserved, and people can do so by calling the Fine Arts Box Office at 551-6661 between noon and 5. Simone Dinnerstein, I thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show. It was an honor and pleasure to speak with you, and we wish you very well with all of the music making that stretches ahead for you.
Thank you so much.
And to finish out this portion of our morning show, I want to play for you the final movement of Maurice Ravel's Piano Concerto in G Major. Simone Dinnerstein's recording of this work is my very, very favorite. Here she is.
Thank you.
concert pianist Simone Dinnerstein in the final movement of Ravel's Piano Concerto in G major. She performs at Carthage College on Thursday evening, a free program at Carthage College's Siebert Chapel, playing Johann Sebastian Bach's Goldberg Variations. Again, the event is free, but tickets are required. You need to reserve your tickets, and you should do so by visiting www.carthage.edu/tickets, or you can call our Fine Arts box office, which is 551-6661. You can call them between noon and 5 to reserve your free ticket to experience the spectacular artistry of pianist Simone Dinnerstein. You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. And the time is coming on 8:47. Part two of The Morning Show is a treat out of the archives. And once again, it is my great pleasure and honor to speak with Rick Steves. And I'm sure many of you know his name well, and the engaging way in which he writes about and speaks about the joys of travel around the world. I'm sure many of you have seen him on PBS and have read various books. On this particular occasion, I reconnect with Rick Steves to talk about a series of travel books, pocketbooks, really, in which you are given all kinds of great ideas about what to see and what to do in wonderful cities like Paris or London or Rome. We're going to talk with Rick Steves about the great care with which he has put these pocket guides together. A tour guide in your pocket is what it says on the back cover. And Rick Steves, we welcome you back to The Morning Show.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
Can you just remind me, I think in our previous conversation we may have talked about this, but maybe you can just give us a reminder of how it is you got interested to such a rabid extent in traveling around the world?
Well, ever since I was a kid, I've been traveling in Europe. My dad used to import pianos from Germany, so he drags me over there as a junior high kid to see the piano factories and then, of course, to see the relatives in Norway. And at first, I wasn't that enthusiastic about it, but I got over there, and it occurred to me, you know, this is really cool. There's different candy, different pop. I remember statuesque women with hairy armpits. And a few years later, I realized I didn't need my parents to travel like that. I saw kids a couple years older than me with their rucksacks and rail passes, and I just thought, yeah, this will be my playground. So I've spent, 3 months a year for the last 30 years in Europe. These days, I'm spending 4 months a year over there. First, I was traveling just for kicks, and then I started learning from my mistakes, and I thought if I could package the lessons I learned from my mistakes into a guidebook or something, other American travelers could learn from my mistakes and have a better, smoother, more economic trip, and I would have a good excuse to go back to Europe every year and update my material, so that's what I do. Well, that was 30 years ago, and now I've got a staff of 80 people, and we've got 30 guidebooks out, and I've got a great publisher, and, my guidebooks are the best-selling guides to every city and country in Europe, but my publisher explained we're missing a very important part of that market, and it's this new trend in America to have small, colorful, portable versions of the big, heavy guidebooks. So these are the pocket guides. And, right off the bat, these are really resonating with the market. People like to, leave the hotel without a lot of junk, and they just stick this book in their pocket, and they've got the information they need to travel smartly.
Tell us about the challenge involved when you are dealing with, in a sense, a smaller template in which there is a whole lot of information that you're probably tempted to pour.
Yeah. Well, what we're assuming is the Americans have the shortest vacations in the rich world, so we're not listing, 10 days' worth of sites here. That's all found in my big 800, 900-page guidebooks to Rome or London or Paris. But these are, 230 pages each, and we have distilled it down to the predictable sites that people are going to want to see. And then we've covered these sites with huge depth so that people do not need to buy a guidebook when they get to the Orsay or the Eiffel Tower or Versailles or the, classical, the old center of Paris. So we've got these self-guided tours here that really are sort of a godsend to any traveler that's overwhelmed by Paris. Here you have 5 self-guided walks in the city or in its great sites, along with practical chapters on how to avoid the crowds and listings of hotels and restaurants and so on. One thing we've done, which is quite innovative, is we've made free audio tours versions of all of the major walks in these books. So you take any of the major walks or museums or palaces that you want to sightsee in Rome or Paris or London, and you can go to ricksteves.com or go to the App Store and get my Rick Steves Audio Europe app, and that gets you the audio tours where then you have free, at your access, beautifully designed, self-guided audio tours, so you don't need to have your head buried in the book while you're out in the Sistine Chapel or walking around the Louvre or the Orsay or cruising the Grand Canal in Venice or whatever. You've got these audio tours that narrate it to you, so you're free just to be lost in the wonder of that space.
Fabulous, fabulous idea. How tricky was it to construct the specifics when it comes to these self-guided tours? And there's a number of them in each of these three pocket guides that I have before me. Talk us through the process by which you, I assume, really perfected each and every one of these tours.
Well, these have been 30 years in the making. For 25 years, I've personally led groups around Paris and London and Rome, and I was hiring local guides and finally got the nerve to do it myself. And then, you know, as a tour guide, you really develop a sixth sense of what people are interested in, what is their attention span, how many Madonnas and children can you show them until they don't care anymore? And, you know, you have to have variety, and you have to have a smart itinerary. You have to put things in historical context. It's plus, you have lots of quirky little things that you want to drop in and see as you're walking around. So you got to design this into a tour, and then you've got to go over there and actually do it. People really remark on how accurate our guidebooks are. It's because I'm personally there every year doing these tours, making sure when I say, you know, step over the street, walk down the little alley, and look up through that window, you'll see actually a guillotine in the bar. Well, you know, that's not necessarily going to be there next year, but the historic guillotine is in this little bar, and that way you can sort of have an intimacy in these tours. So we're sticking our necks out to have people follow us so carefully. And we do it the old-fashioned way by updating these guidebooks in person every year. And they really work, and we take it seriously. My name's on the cover, and I want these books to be the best books out there. And it's just really fun tour guiding for me.
I'm sure. I have in front of me Paris, Rome, and London. Are these the first three, and at this point, only three pocket guides like this?
Yeah, we've covered all the major cities in Europe, and you know, I also have a tour company where we take 1 week tours to the big cities all around Europe, and it's clear to me from my tour experience what people are interested in doing according to what sells, and then when we do it, how do we spend the best week in each of these cities? And London, Paris, and Rome are far and away the best selling tour destinations for 1 week tours. They're the best selling normal guidebooks. So these are the books that we decided to do at the first whack at this new series with my publisher. From a sales point of view, I'm really happy with my publisher just knows how to sell books. I'm really lucky to be working with them. And, you know, we've got 30 books out, and our books are the best-selling books for every region in Europe, the best-selling France, Paris, Ireland, Spain, Italy, you name it. But we were missing a whole growing sales segment in this travel publishing industry, and that's called pocket guides. And they are, you know, they've got these, you know, you look at Frommer and Fodor and The Lonely Planet, and they have the big full-fledged guidebooks, which are my favorite guidebooks still, but they all find that the little companion book, whether it's called Top 10 or Day at a Time or Snapshot or Pocket Guide, these little companion guides that are full-color, shiny paper, slip it in your pocket, they've been selling as well as the big normal guidebooks. So right out of the starting gate, these three books are fourth, fifth, and sixth best sellers out of all 30 books. So, you know, this was a market segment we were just completely neglecting. And my publisher said, no, this is not going to take sales away from your big full-fledged Paris and Rome and London guides. This is a different market. And people are buying a Frommer book or a Fodor book or a Lonely Planet book because we don't have a book in that category. So from a business point of view, it's really exciting to have these out. And we've got probably three more pocket guides in the works. Which are a fun thing to look forward to.
For three other cities, you mean?
Yeah.
Very good. You have included with each of them a pretty significantly sized pull-out map. And
right.
I think that's a wonderful idea. We don't always see that in guidebooks like this.
Right. Well, one thing I want to do is, because I'm over there 4 months out of the year. I'm a tour guide. I get a lot of feedback and suggestions and so on from my readers on the road. I was just over there for 2 months until a week ago working on these books. And people I don't want people to get over there and have to buy things. I don't want them to have to buy a museum, a guidebook to Versailles. And if you go out to Versailles and you don't have it, you know, every guidebook lists it, but most guidebooks don't cover it room by room as I do. They don't give you the historical context as we do. They don't tell you how you can rent a bike and go out and explore the grounds and get out to Marie Antoinette's little hamlet where she dressed up like a peasant girl. You know, these sort of things I want to include in the book so people don't have to, out of desperation, buy it there at the site where you have to wait in line, where you have to buy a lousy, boring translated edition, and where you have to spend a lot of extra money. And the maps are something that people get, they really have a need for, and they end up buying them on the streets in Europe, and they're very expensive. And we design the maps ourselves. With new publishing technology, we can include them in the book quite economically. And these little pocket guides consequently come with a color map, and they're half the price of the normal guidebook. So they're cheaper. They really do it for somebody who's got a short visit to these sites and doesn't want to have you know, an exhaustive collection of all the restaurants and hotels, but just wants the very best listed. So yeah, it's really fun to try to figure out the market. And I'll tell you, Americans have the shortest vacations in the rich world, and it is really quite important not to overwhelm people with superlatives, but to cut right through that and say, if you've got 3 days in Rome, this is exactly how we'd spend them. One thing, Greg, that we've put on this in these books, which I think gives them an extra sort of value, we've included free audio versions of the tours in the books that you can just download on our app. And the app is entirely free. The Android version just came out, and you get it through the ricksteves.com website or at the App Store. And then that gives you carefully crafted, self-guided audio tours to all the major sites in Paris, Rome, and London, along with other great cities all over Europe. This has been very popular, so people don't have to have their head buried in the book when they're at St. Peter's Basilica or at the Sainte-Chapelle or out at Versailles. They can be lost in the wonder of that site with me as their tour guide in their ear. And for me, it's just a real fun way to amplify my teaching and to make it available in a way that's free and easy for people to use.
Hmm. These are really marvelous books. I can see how terrific they would be, and I anticipate seeing London for the first time in the next couple of years, and look forward to having this in my pocket with me. And again, these three pocket guides are all you need for a quick trip, a relatively quick trip to Paris, to London, or to Rome, each published by Avalon Travel. And Rick Steves, a great pleasure talking with you about these marvelously crafted books, and best wishes and safe travels to you.
Well, thank you so much, and get a hold of me before your London trip. I'd love to help you out.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, I speak with Nick Berudian and Edson Melendez from the Bell Ensemble about their next performances that are coming up this weekend, performances of the delightful comic opera La Serva Patrona by Giovanni Pergolesi, performances that will be occurring Friday evening and Sunday afternoon in the Assembly Hall at DeKoven Center in Racine. And on Thursday, Dr. Art Sear pays his monthly visit to the program to talk about an array of current events and current issues. Support for The Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. We remind you of Wisconsin Public Radio's winter membership drive currently underway, and you can make a donation to Wisconsin Public Radio and support all that they do and all that we do here at WGTD. You can donate at www.wpr.org or